From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
First time in the Oval Office for the President and Mrs. Macri, and it's a great, great honor to have them here.
U.S. President Donald Trump played host to Mauricio Macri, the president of Argentina, and his wife this past Thursday.
Been my friend for many years. We've known each other for long prior to politics. And who would have thought this was going to happen? Over. For both of us.
For more on that, we spoke with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. Mr. Macri sitting down with his buddy, Mr. Trump, in Washington, and both of them surprised that they're in the current positions they have, like much of the rest of the world, I think.
I think Macri played in the election in Argentina in November 2015, and he deliberately played a campaign where, and he left it so much vague, whereas so that when he got in, he then completely betrayed the image that he'd projected during the electoral campaign of some kind of moderate center-right type.
Former, right.
And he completely betrayed that image. Whereas Trump made specific promises and then he's been reneging on them like crazy, apart from the only one that I can remember that he's kept is taking the United States out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that may well have alerted people in the U.S. Sometimes refer to as the deep state, to the fact that Trump had to be neutralized in some way. I don't know if that's an accurate reading of what happened, but
I share the same reading, and they went on that as job one, like wall to wall.
Right. And so, and in Macri's case, the establishment, the oligarchy in Argentina, actually welcomed him in.
Right.
Because he's one of theirs.
Right. He's their boy.
Yeah. So there are some kind of subtle differences in the political background to the way the two leaders came to power, but not very significant ones. And they're both two extreme right-wing politicians who are committed to implementing an agenda that defends the power, influence, control, status, prestige of the oligarchies of which they're respectively a part.
Well, see, now, you have a similarity there with the entire U.S. political establishment is on that page, whereas in Argentina, you at least had reformers in opposition to that playbook that had power, the past president and her husband, Néstor Kirchner and Cristina da Silva Kirchner.
And Macri presumably was welcomed with open arms, all of the complete red carpet treatment in Washington, because he sold Argentina to the United States elites.
Well, Obama, in essence, brought him a check for like $12 billion on that sovereign fund stuff, remember?
Right, yeah. And so, and what he's done is he's, and if you look at the figures, I can't remember the precise figures, but he's increased Argentina's foreign debt to something like $160 billion.
Right.
He's increased it by $80 billion, which is, and I think it's either at the level or close to the level that it was in the Argentine crisis back in 2000, 2001, 2002.
Right.
Which is what enabled Néstor Kirchner to get into office and eventually use his office in a way that gave his political option, a progressive political option, power.
Right.
And he was, because to begin with, he was in a very difficult situation, but the decisions that he took and the strategy that he applied enabled him to develop a power base of support among people in Argentina, which is what enabled his wife, Cristina, I think Nestor Kirchner had two terms.
Right.
Then Christina, his wife, was able to get elected president, and she served two terms. Unfortunately, Nestor Kirchner died soon after, not long after she won the presidency back in 2008 for her first term. But and the point about that is that, and they Argentina had 16 years of progressive government, but so then people will say, well, okay, well, why did the Argentinians vote for a right-wing president like Macri? And the reason was something that we've discussed at various times in our recent conversations, or our conversations over the last couple of years, that the international context created a recessionary economy in all of Latin America, which is the backdrop to both events in Argentina, but also more importantly to events in Venezuela. Right. And one of the things that's so extraordinary about Western corporate media coverage and Western media coverage in general of events in Latin America is they all focus on the difficulties that Venezuela's going through, but they completely omit or almost completely omit the difficulties that are going on in Argentina. There was a massive May Day demonstration in Buenos Aires yesterday, in rejecting the policies that Mauricio Macri has applied. Now, for a long time, I was puzzled about why, what is it? What is Macri's agenda? And because if he and the people that back him are thinking in terms of maintaining themselves in power, then of their policies are completely wrong, completely counterproductive. There's no doubt at all that in the next general elections in Argentina, people in Argentina will again vote for the progressive policies represented by Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner and Daniel Scioli, who lost the election to Macri last time around. And I think I've been completely wrong to think in those terms. I don't think that the right wing elites in Latin America are thinking in terms of, you know, how are we going to prolong ourselves in power? What they want to do is roll back. They want to take the opportunity of rolling back the economic status quo and the social political status quo so far in just two or three years, which is, and you can see this happening also in Brazil, that it'll take another 8 years, another decade of progressive government to put right what the sabotage that they're essentially engaged in to defend their interests right now. And I think that is the right reading now. And I think it was a mistake to think that the right wing are in any way interested in the facade of political power. What they want is to do something so fundamental economically and socially that it'll take another 10 years if progressive forces return to power in Argentina, which is very likely, for them to make good the damage that the right wing have done in the two or three years that Macri has been in power now. He's set Argentina back a decade.
Yeah, you
and
know,
the same thing's happening in Brazil.
Absolutely.
And that is their agenda. It's not an agenda of staying in power.
Well, if you look at both places, the history of both places, it's quite possible that their plan to stay in power has nothing to do with elections as well. certainly, right. You know, if it's necessary in another year, two or three, of looting the economy to install a junta that rules for 8 to 10 or 12 years or whatever, they're going to try it, and they'll have backing from the United States most likely again.
Yeah, and that's certainly a scenario that can't be ruled out, although it looks extremely unlikely at the moment.
I don't think the people.
And as you say, things can change, and it can change very quickly. And if one looks at Venezuela, and maybe we should start talking about Venezuela.
Yeah, let's do.
And if you look at Venezuela, what's happening there is that the right wing opposition there, completely backed by the United States government, obviously, but also by the regional right wing. They they have shown very clearly that they have a completely fascist agenda. And I use the term fascist advisedly because my definition of fascism is an intimate alliance between corporate business interests, the corporate elites in our countries, and government. And so if you look at what's happening in Venezuela in 2015, at the end of 2015, the Venezuelan opposition managed to do very well, extremely well, in the legislative elections there, making complete nonsense of their own claims that they lived in a dictatorship. Now, and then what they proceeded to do was to act in a way completely against Venezuela's constitution, so as to sabotage the relationship, the institutional stability that had prevailed in Venezuela prior to their election win in those legislative elections of 2015. And that's what they've been dedicating themselves to ever since. And they are now in a situation where they're getting more and more desperate because the extremely favorable conditions that they enjoyed back in first half of 2016, certainly, and probably for most of 2016, are now evaporating because they had a very they had a very strong agenda of taking advantage of the dramatic drop in the oil price, which at one point dropped below, what was it, dropped below $30 in 2016.
Yeah.
And so, and that's absolutely crucial for an economy like Venezuela's, which is in transition between being dependent on oil rents, on oil income, as it has been for the last, whatever it is, 60, 70, 80 years. And the policies that have been accelerated, they began under Hugo Chavez, but they've been accelerated under Nicolas Maduro, to diversify the Venezuelan economy away from its dependence on oil. And one of the signs of that was that last year in 2016, Nicolas Maduro and his team presented a budget for 2017 that maintained social spending the same level, I think it's an even higher level, than it had been through 2016. And why are they able to do that? Because they've made progress diversifying the income, the tax income, the fiscal income that the Venezuelan state receives from the non-oil economy. Now, they're still heavily dependent on oil, but as they make progress diversifying the Venezuelan economy, the political agenda for the Venezuelan opposition becomes much more complicated, and also the self-defeating policy that they've employed, the self-defeating strategy that they've employed, takes us back to my remarks about what is the agenda of the right wing in countries like Argentina and Brazil.
Well, before we go there, I want to just sort of probe this last phenomenon a little bit more. You know, the situation that we see facing, you know, resource countries, you know, commodities, sources, like people that are oil producers and, you know, mining and all of that. It seemed almost like the markets were tanked intentionally, you know, back when you had the collapse in prices. It was politically very convenient in the United States to have a drop in oil prices, which had been soaring and was a source of tension and a source of stress on the economy. Also, it came at a time when they were looking to punish Russia. You know, the continued attack, it's always convenient to beat up on Venezuela for the United States ever since 1998. You know, you had the Saudis sort of managing this assault on oil prices. And what you saw as a response from Russia even was okay, you know what? We're vulnerable here. Let's diversify our economy. Because that was accompanied by sanctions, of course, that, well, we're not going to sell you this, that, or the other thing. You can't buy Parmesan cheese from the EU anymore. So they start producing their own, things like this. And so, in other words, this reaction from the local economy to this economic warfare is to strengthen itself, essentially, to diversify, to advance. And we've had this dynamic also with respect to progressive governments being able to implement progressive changes to build socialism, as many call it, where politically it seems not viable at certain points, or even they move very cautiously to not provoke a response. You know, suddenly it's put on the table that, you know, the solution to your problem is aggressive government intervention in the economy. And so we've seen that, for example, start to manifest in Venezuela with respect to the distribution chain. So, you know, I wanted to kind of show this larger context that there's this economic warfare going on, and that the response to the attacks from the U.S. and its allies, you know, is very often something that promotes the growth and health of the local economy, you know, with the independence of it, the diversification of it, and the, you know, moving towards a socialization of it.
Yeah. I agree with everything that you said there, Don. And one element that is probably important to talk about here is also the fact that Venezuela and the other ALBA countries, Cuba, Bolivia, Ecuador, Nicaragua, the Caribbean island nations that are members of ALBA, they all believe that regional integration is also key. You know, there's no point trying to do stuff just in your own country. You've got to try and develop a regional strategy, a consensus around a regional strategy. And that's also part of what the right-wing agenda is designed to sabotage. But I just wanted to go back to quickly to what I was saying. I was very puzzled about, well, why is the right-wing opposition in Venezuela behaving in such a counterproductive way, which is bound to turn opinion against them in the medium and long term? And the answer is, well, and what in my opinion, what I was trying to elucidate about the events in Argentina and Brazil, that the right wing aren't interested in staying in power as such, or staying in office, perhaps is the correct phrase, yeah. Because they believe that if they can roll back the achievements of the progressive governments over the last 10 years, that'll be enough to keep them in power without being in political office, and to force progressive governments it's a bit like Sisyphus, the myth of Sisyphus, this guy rolling the stone up the top of the hill and then it rolls down again, and he's condemned to do that for eternity. And it's as if the right-wing agenda is to turn progressive forces into some kind of Sisyphus that is eternally condemned to making progress that is then destroyed. And that seems to me to be the psychology behind the Venezuelan political strategy in Venezuela. But the problem for them is that their behavior is so counterproductive now. The majority opinion in Venezuela has actually swung back, from what I can gather, in favor of the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro. Now, perhaps the most important thing that's happened over the last week, Don, is that Venezuela has begun the process to withdraw from the Organization of American States.
That's right.
Because and Nicolas Maduro formalized that process in a letter that he wrote to Secretary General of the OEA, sorry, the OAS, Luis Almagro, the former Uruguayan foreign minister. And he wrote in that letter very clearly that the OAS is simply a tool, a puppet, and has always been a shameful has always carried out a shameful role as a neo-colonial stooge of the United States government. And he pretty much puts that in so many words in his letter. And he contrasts that role of the OAS with the need for regional integration based on sovereignty, autonomy, and independence. He makes very clear that he regards the future of regional political and economic structures to lie in the community of Latin American and Caribbean states, CELAC, other similar organizations like UNISOR, which exclude the countries of North America, United States, and Canada. So that withdrawal from the OAS, and it's very symbolic and also, in my view, quite problematic, because although it's completely understandable and personally I support the decision, I don't, insofar as that matters at all, and more importantly, other countries, in particular Bolivia and Cuba, have expressed their support for President Nicolas Maduro's decision to take Venezuela out of the OAS, and Evo Morales, the Bolivian president, has actually been very specific in accusing the OAS in its attack on Venezuela, because it's no doubt at all that over the last 9 months, certainly, and ever since Luis Almagro became the Secretary General of the Organization of American States under the patronage of the United States, very clearly, and he's been engaged in a completely irregular campaign in terms of the rules of the Organization of American States. He's broken the various rules in the various norms of the Organization of American States as an organization in order to carry forward his attack on the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela. And Evo Morales over the last couple of days has said that, in his opinion, that what that amounts to is not just an attack on Venezuela, but actually an attempted coup d'etat against Venezuela. And much more broadly, Evo Morales argued that, in fact, it constitutes a coup d'etat against the whole Latin American region, because it's aimed at setting back the work of progressive governments in the region in a way that in effect constitutes what Evo Morales regards as a coup d'etat, because it's denying ordinary people, the great majority of people in Latin America, the political option of trying to defend their interests. I think that's important to emphasize, that there's a lot of support at a very high level for Venezuela's decision to leave the OAS, but there are also misgivings about it. And I was watching Daniel Ortega's address for the 1st of May, I often forget that in the United States you don't celebrate the 1st of May as Labor Day.
Nope.
Your Labor Day is much later in the year, isn't it?
Yep.
But I know, and it's a tremendously important day here in Latin America. So there was a huge May Day demonstration in Managua, and also later in the day, President Ortega, he made an address in honor of May Day, and I was expecting him to say something along the lines of, "We support Venezuela's decision to leave the OAS." He didn't say that, but nor did he say that he did not support it. What he made a very clear and strong expression of support for the government of Nicolas Maduro. But I thought it was interesting that he didn't actually, as far as I remember, I was paying quite close attention, and I didn't hear him say anything about Venezuela's decision to leave the OAS. And I think the reason he didn't is because there are some misgivings among the political leadership in the region about, you know, how positive and how constructive is Venezuela leaving the OAS in terms of the defense of Venezuela against the regional assault that it's suffering, the in support of the internal attempt at a fascist coup by the Venezuelan opposition. And the reason that those misgivings exist, I think, is because if Venezuela, for example, or if the other countries in general decided, well, we'll leave the OAS as well, that would leave the field wide open for the right-wing governments to apply sanctions. And I think it was a total of 17 governments or 18 governments that voted for some kind of sanctions or some kind of intervention, the activation of the Carta Democratica, which is the democratic charter in the OAS, which is the mechanism which will enable the US government and its right-wing allies in the region to activate sanctions against Venezuela. Now, if Venezuela and the other countries leave the OAS, what's to stop the OAS from activating that charter? What's to stop them activating that mechanism to deepen their attack against Venezuela? So, and I think there are some misgivings about the decision by Nicolas Maduro to leave the OAS, although it's perfectly understandable. I don't think that you're going to see the other ALBA countries leaving the OAS, because they'll need to stay inside the OAS to maintain a sufficient quorum against any measures that Luis Almagro and his right-wing allies are conspiring to take. Using the OAS as a regional weapon to attack Venezuela. So I think it was important internally, certainly, and certainly as a regional statement by Nicolas Maduro that they're not putting up with this kind of interventionism from the United States and its allies anymore. It'll be interesting to see how things pan out over the next 2 or 3 months. And I don't think that other progressive governments, will in fact leave the OAS, because it's just too dangerous at this particular moment.
Yeah, they can stay in. You can have an inside and outside game that way. I mean, Venezuela is the target, so they walk, and the others who don't like that whole dynamic stay in and fight it.
Yeah, and I think something that Daniel Ortega said yesterday is well worth bearing in mind, and I think you mentioned this in our conversation before we started recording, that it's really important to understand that what's happening now is not some kind of new development in Venezuela. Venezuela has been subject to a permanent coup attempt, if you like, over the last 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, more than that. It's almost 20 years now since 98 was when Comandante Chavez won the election, I think.
Yes.
But I think it was January 99 that he actually took office as president. But ever since then, and the United States and its allies have been trying to attack Venezuela. They mounted a coup in 2002 against Venezuela, which was unsuccessful. Then, as Daniel Ortega was recalling yesterday, the right-wing opposition staged almost a year of outright economic sabotage. And during that year, the right-wing controlled the personnel, the management of the state oil company, PDVSA. And it was a real struggle for Hugo Chavez to get his people into control of PDVSA, but he did so. And they defeated the right-wing economic sabotage back then in 2003, 2004. They won the recall re-election, the recall referendum in 2004. That was what really consolidated power of the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela back then. And now what's happening is a kind of a reenactment and another attempt. You're seeing the same thing, mass demonstrations by the opposition to try and provoke instability and crisis in the country. And so far, over 20 people have been killed in events of one kind or another, almost all of them provoked by the right-wing opposition. And back in 2002, one has to remember that a key element of the attempted coup d'etat was that opposition snipers killed their own people.
And at the time, those shootings were being blamed on government forces. It was clearly done in order to provoke outrage at the government forces, and it was revealed. And we got to leave it there. Tony, thank you very much.
Okay, you're very welcome, Don. Look forward to talking to you again.
The same thing.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.